Some women impersonate Sex and the City's Carrie Bradshaw with vast closets full of fantastic clothing. Even Sarah Jessica Parker pretends to be Carrie Bradshaw when she walks the red carpet. However, there is one woman in New York City who, if he knew her, would have been Darren Star's real muse. Let me introduce you to Susan S. Warner, the adorable petite blonde who at 59 lost her handsome, extraordinary husband to cancer 6 months after her wonderful 32-year-old son died by suicide. It's now 4 years later. After the most challenging days and nights, Susan decided to live her best life possible. And just like that, Susan was suddenly single. Carrie may have Susan beat on exposure, but Susan has Carrie beat on life's experiences. Listen in.
Our last podcast gave you insight into Susan's very difficult journey. She is quick to affirm that this was a rough road fashioned with an overarching desire to move forward. But it wasn't easy. Susan firmly believes that people do not have to get caught in a cycle of profound sadness and depression if they discover that there is more out there to live for. Even though there have been many dark days since her son and husband's death, Susan decided early on that she was going to live her best possible life. She comes from a long line of resiliency, and that pointed her to a chapter two. One of the ways that she made that happen was by planning ahead and forming routines and disciplines that kept her safe, secure, and fulfilled. Susan, were you scared?
I think scared is probably the perfect word to describe how I felt. We all venture in the unknown in several things that we do in life, but this was an unknown that I was not prepared for and had no idea how I was going to pick up and move forward. David and Michael's death completely destroyed me as a person and completely destroyed what I had known as my life. So yes, scared is a perfect way to put it. Terrified.
How did you know? I'm really curious about this. How did you know from the get-go that, you know, your life was livable?
That's a good question, Lois. Because of what I have historically had in my life, the death of my mother at an early age, and then David's suicide, I have always had an overwhelming desire to live. I've never entertained ideas of not moving forward. So even though I was shattered by these deaths, I was aware that I was put on this earth to continue. Something that dawned on me after Michael's death, over a year after Michael's death, one day like a light bulb went off, and I realized that one day in the far, far future, when I'm old and feeble, I'm going to get to see him again. I'm going to meet up with him again spiritually. And that gave me a lot of solace too, once I made that realization. But I am one of those people that I would probably classify as a survivor, and I want to live. I've always wanted to live. So, and that's been evident in the way I live my life, in my health care, in most of the steps I take in life. So even in his prognosis, when I knew it was grim, I knew I wanted to live and move forward. Not that I didn't love him and David with all my heart, and not that my life wasn't shattered after their death, but I was confident that I could go on and I would go on and try to live my best life.
Did Michael know that about you?
Yes. Yes, he did. And I think at some point, we had a saying, because Michael traveled so much, and we would miss each other but say that our marriage was charmed because we were in so many reunions all the time. But we would always say that the person that stayed home missed the person that went away more. And it became like a cute little thing with us. And as he was getting sicker and sicker, you know, I said, I'm going to miss you more. I'm staying home. You're going on a journey. So he did know that. He did know the resiliency, and he loved that about me. He did.
I think those are such important words that you have shared with everyone. It's amazing because, you know, you are so strong, but I don't want people to think that you don't have the same exact feelings that they have. So I think that was great to explain that situation to them. So with all that went on, weren't you mentally exhausted?
Mentally exhausted, physically exhausted, physically not fit. I wasn't eating. Michael wasn't eating. I wasn't eating. Yeah, mentally exhausted. But, you know, I have to tell you that exhaustion entered into widowhood in that everything that you did as a couple and that you shared responsibility on, both emotionally, financially, physically, becomes all yours. So there are times that I'm still emotionally and mentally exhausted. Yeah. As I've explained before, friends and family that have helped me pick up the pieces and sometimes are just there to share in the responsibilities have been an extraordinary help to me. I also want to digress a minute, Lois, to your point about moving forward and picking up your life, not demonstrating the depth of your hurt. That's not true. Just like I would never judge anybody else's grief or the depth of someone's grief, if someone loses a 92-year-old parent and they're devastated, I'm not judging that. So people should never judge someone's recovery as loving less or caring less or being less shattered. So there's not a one-to-one relationship with that. Just because you decide to move forward and live your best life doesn't mean that you didn't love them as much or weren't as shattered or devastated by their death. They are not mutually exclusive. That's really important to me.
I completely understand. I completely understand. I'm glad you mentioned that as well. A lot of people that know you have asked me, you know, did you take any medication or what was life like right afterwards?
Yeah, I'm not a medication kind of girl. It doesn't work for me. Also, David suffered from addiction, so I really am not one that turns to medication personally. So no, I did not. I found outlets in exercise, in Netflix, in friends, in conversation, in social life, not dating early on, but in seeking out my friends. So no, medication was not my way to go. I never believed in dulling how I felt. I didn't think that would help. And that goes for alcohol as well.
I was just about to ask you. So was it alcohol, weed, anything at all that
no,
you
took? No, no. I like my glass of wine, mm-hmm. but no, it was not. It was not. I never found that dulling my senses helped me at all. I needed to be in it, and I needed to be able to think through it, and I needed to find the ways. My mother was a health teacher, and she always talked about mental mechanisms, walk it out, talk it out, think it out. Those work really well for me. I've carried them through my entire life. Walk it out, talk it out, think it out, meaning walk it out, exercise, talk it out. You know, with friends or therapists, think it out, same. So I've tried to use those mental mechanisms to work through this.
That's a good lesson for all of us. At some point, mm-hmm. we'll have to go.
She taught me that young.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking and where did you go for the first few weeks and months? I'm trying to picture you, like what you look like, how you acted. Are you the same person today as you were then?
No, I am not the same person. I believe I have grown enormously. So no, but the first few weeks were surreal. As you know, I'm Jewish and we sit Shiva. And that, as mind-numbing and soul-numbing as that was, it's there for a reason. It keeps you from going too deep into yourself and being surrounded by people that care about you, people that would tell stories about your loved ones. It did dawn on me that I was sitting Shiva 6 months apart in my apartment for my son and my husband, and that was not good. One of my friends from college who is modern Orthodox came over and I said to him, what do I do? Like, how do I break this cycle? And he looked at me and he said, move. You need to get out of this environment. I said, I can't. You know, I'm locked into owning this apartment. He said, okay. He said, then I'm going to do something for you. And he sent over a new mezuzah with his rabbi to change the karma of my life. And whether you believe that or not, whether I believe that or not, the gesture was really heartwarming and wonderful. I did move, you know, about 6 months after. And I felt good about that. And I've discussed that, finding my own space. But I did establish routines and stay in routines that kept me comfortable and kept me going. And I almost did them robotically so that I could continue on in life.
I think that was very insightful of him to say that. What do you think he knows that we don't know that he said move? I mean, that's a loaded suggestion.
Yeah. He felt he was relating it more to, you know, Jewish law and an idea that, you know, when the karma in a place is so negative that you might want to change it. And it's funny, now that I look back on it, my moving and selling my apartment really did not have anything to do with that, I don't think. Maybe subconsciously it did. But I know that whether it was for karma, or it was for psychological reasons, it worked, and it worked well for me. So maybe a lot of these laws, like Shiva, like moving, are based actually in psychological premise that just keeps you healthier when you leave the environment that was so mindful of where you were. I know a lot of people find comfort in staying in those environments where their loved ones were, and I would never fault them for that if that works for them. For me, it did not. I needed to find my own place to try to eliminate some ghosts. So it's an interesting question, whether that's based in psychology or whether it's based in a little bit more of mysticism, but that was his comment, move. And since I couldn't, he changed the mezuzah, and then I did move shortly after that. My friend Alan did that.
Yeah, that also separates you from most people. Hold on a minute.
Yeah, and I've discussed that. The reasons were personal. The reasons were personal for moving. They were my reasons. A lot of it because of needing to find my own way, needing to jump out of where I was to try to start fresh. But as I said, based in mysticism or based in psychology, I don't know, but it worked for me.
Well, as I started to say before, you know, most people probably, you know, wouldn't move because they would feel guilty or wasn't loyal or, you know, I never want to forget. I want the reminder. I don't want to, you know, they want to move on. They want to move forward, but they really don't want to move on. You know, or
everybody,
you know,
has to do what's right for them, though. They have to do the things that make them the most comfortable, that makes life the most livable for them. I can only tell you what worked for me. But I will never criticize someone who has another plan that works for them.
Okay. Again, I just want to ask that question over again. You know, like, what were you mostly thinking about? did you have like a lot of pity for yourself? Did you feel like why me? Why was I singled out? I see everybody else as couples. What happened? You know, where did I make the wrong turn? Any of those feelings? And before you answer that, let me just say, I'm not just trying to make this up. I was 31. My father died. I couldn't look at, you know, older men his age functioning around. Whenever I saw them walking down the street in Manhattan, or if I went to Florida to visit my in-laws, I swear to God, I would put my hand over my forehead when we came down the escalator off the plane, and I couldn't stand watching all of those men and women waiting for their children because I didn't have a father anymore. And I literally put my hand over my eyes because it made me nauseous.
But you evolved past that, right?
Oh, yeah, but it took me a while. But I'm asking you selfishly, did you have any of those feelings?
You know, in the beginning, if you asked me how I felt, it was self-preservation. all I could think about was getting through the day, getting through the week, getting through the month. Yes, it was self-preservation. I took my daughter to Paris for Father's Day. So Michael died March 18th. For Father's Day, I took her to Paris because I wanted to get her out of the country, out of the commercialization of Father's Day. And that was the best thing I could think to do. And I remember day two in Paris looking at her and saying, for the first time, I feel like me. No one's looking at me, cocking their head and defining me by that woman.
Right.
No one knows who I am. The anonymity was wonderful. I took a breath and felt like me. And I took that home with me, that I could become myself again. For the first few months, I was like walking dead, you know, just going through the movements, going through the motions, you know, getting food into my mouth, hardly, walking the dog, just going through the motions like a ghost. And then Paris was a bit of a turning point for me when I realized that out in the big world, I was just a cog in the wheel and no one really, you know, no one really changed their life and I could be me again. Yes, I was very jealous of couples. Not jealous, not envious, I suppose. I would look at couples on the street. I would look at couples and say, what happened? You know, I don't get it. What happened? I never in a million years thought that this would be my fate. Michael was strong and virile and healthy and came from parents who lived into their late 80s. And he was, you know, exercise. We spun together all the time. All my brother and brothers-in-law would joke, Michael's the fit one. I never saw this coming. We were riding into the sunset together into old age. So mm-hmm. This was a complete shock in 8 weeks. This wasn't going to be me. I was not going to be a young widow. Mm-mm. So there was a whole lot of, you know, reconciliation in the whole process. This was not going to be my life. And here I was. I got up every morning and I got up grateful for the new day. You know, when I have a bad day, my line always is, I make it through the day and tomorrow the sun rises. And it's not that day anymore. And I really live by that. You know, anniversaries of death, bad days. I'll always say, and now it's tomorrow. And tomorrow is infinitely better, usually. So I lived by that. The sun was going to rise the next day, and I was going to be here. And then as days went by and my routines got set and I began to live my life, I learned that I can live my life. I'm going to recreate myself and be Susan, like 2.0.
I think that's very profound, because if you can get that into your head and you do experience that, then life gets easier. But, you know, if you can't rely on that or you don't know that that is going to happen, it's very rough. It just becomes like an impossible situation. So, so anyway, when did you start to socialize, or did you work? Like right away. And I don't mean socialized dating. I mean, you know, going to someone's house for dinner, or, you know, meeting up with a girlfriend for, you know, a cup of coffee
Right away. So I have a routine in the morning where I meet some very close friends in Riverside Park with our dogs. And I've been doing this since the day I moved into Manhattan. I met them, and two of them, Anne and Elizabeth, are probably my guardian angels. Mm-hmm. They were there to listen. They were there to shake me. We talk about pop culture. We talk about politics. We talk about the animals. They are the kindest, most giving, smartest women I know. And almost every morning we would meet, and they protected me and sheltered me and made sure I was there and validated me and listened to me and brought out things in me and questions. And I think that morning routine is probably what put me on the best path, and I owe it to
them.
Wow. Yep.
So what time do you meet them, and how long? What time do you meet them, and how long do you stay together?
I meet them usually between 7 and 8 a.m. And some days I don't return home for 2 hours. So if I hit the street at 7 with my dog, I get home at 9-ish, and we put in about 12,000 steps, and Winston's exhausted, and I've gotten to see my friends and talk about life.
So how do you know when to meet?
This has been going on for a long time.
Yeah,
we text each other in the morning.
Oh.
We text the night before, everybody up for it. If anybody has plans or can't or something's going on, no, I'm not available. If not, I go someplace else in the park. But this happens pretty much about now 50% of the week. And it's magnificent, truly magnificent. I owe them so much in friendship.
So what happens when someone loses a dog?
Well, so far we're okay. One of the dogs is very old and very sick, and I'll tell you about that when it happens. I don't know. We're all dear friends.
You'll still meet because it's the walking. That's it. Or
probably, but I don't know if it's when zero out and it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if they're going to want to come out so badly, but hopefully, I'll tell you how that plays out. How about that?
Okay.
So far, so good.
Okay. What made you devise a plan for yourself? You talked a little bit about that, but you were very insightful to do that because the routine gave you options rather than wallowing away. So
right. I think it was instinct. I am a planner. I am that person that wants to know, Tuesday night I'm doing this and Wednesday night I'm doing this, although more spontaneous now than ever now. But I like to know what I'm doing. So I did that. I made plans. And my friends and family were extraordinary at that. I also had friends that would call me at 4 o'clock on a Friday night and say, my husband and I are going to dinner at this restaurant in your neighborhood. Will you join us? And at the time, if I didn't have plans, absolutely. As I got more secure, I made more plans. And there was a moment where the bell rang and I realized that I needed to make plans, that you can't just wait for your husband to come home, or if we just decide to go to dinner alone, it's okay because he's not coming home. Right. So that was a real elbow turn in this, when I realized that I needed to make plans for weekends, for Saturday night, for Wednesday night, and that worked really well for me as well. I discussed that Saturday nights, when most couples had things to do, understandably, I would go to the movie. I have a theater right near me. I would go to an 8 o'clock movie. I'd walk Winston. I'd go to the movies. I'd get home by 10:30. I saw a movie, didn't mind going alone, and the night was over. And I did that for a solid year. It was wonderful until COVID hit.
Right. Wow.
And I started dating. And I started dating after that. But that was my weekend routine, and it worked. Look, my daughter will tell you there were weekends that I would call her and it was heavy on her heart because I was alone. You had to really make plans, and I learned to make plans. I would go out to my house out east by myself, and that worked too. So it was an evolution of learning the routines that worked for me. And as I established them, I got much more comfortable in who I was and established a newfound independence. And that really helped start me on the growth pattern.
Mm. Out east, do you have another group of friends? Or is it friends from
New
York?
In the summer, both. But in the winter, it's a little bit more desolate. But, I would come out here. I would do my work. I would do my exercise. Occasionally, someone would be out here that I knew, and we'd have dinner. But it was a good breakup. It was good. And it was, let me think, let me breathe. It worked.
And the isolation, not being in the city, not hearing a lot of, humans around, didn't.
No, I like it. I stay out here all week by myself in the summer. I like it. Mm-hmm. I like the.
Do you go out there by yourself in the winter too?
Sometimes. Still, okay. Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm that person. I like it.
So that leads me to the next question. Do you like being alone?
I do. And you know what? And I will credit my daughter, Elizabeth, on this. When she said to me one day when I was not happy, she said, you need to find out who you are if you like to be alone and make yourself happy to be alone. And it really was like she slapped me across the face. Like that's not me. I'm not that person. And I really went on a campaign to work about liking to be alone and setting up my own routines and being that person that can eat by themselves and, jump into bed at 9 o'clock if I want to and be content and to be able to go to the movies by myself and go to theater by myself and do all those things that I would encourage any single woman to do, whether she was in my situation or 20 or 30. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn to like me and like my own company. And I did. and that has carried into relationships even, because to this day, I like my time alone as well as my time with a companion.
Mm-hmm.
I like that duality a lot.
So before you...
That was a journey. That was a journey.
Okay. What about, you said that exercise helped you a lot. Explain that to our audience.
Exercise, I do SoulCycle, which is a little bit more zen than regular exercise. But that, losing yourself in physical fitness, has always been important to me. And I can go on a bike. And when we first suffered our losses, we had been doing SoulCycle, Michael and I and Elizabeth, very rigorously. And that whole community completely embraced us. The two master teachers, Lori Cole and Stacey Griffith, put our bikes so that they could watch us, Elizabeth and I, and said to us from the onset, if you get sad, if you need to get off that bike, go, which you're never allowed to do. And they have kept a watchful eye on both of us for the last 4 years, to this day. And to this day, they'll play a song that was one of Michael's favorites, and they'll look at me and like point up to heaven. They're extraordinary. So that whole community, and that was people who ran the front desk, everybody embraced Elizabeth and I and cocooned us. And that was really, really special and has carried through to this day.
Do you still do that together?
Yes. Yes. And the community of SoulCycle is still extraordinary to Elizabeth and I.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They made such a difference. Yes, such a difference, I can't tell you, in so many ways. And they were so special. And I will never forget any of them for the kindness that they have shown us and the care and the love. I also wanted to go back to horseback riding. I did that last summer. I lost myself in the relationship with the animal. It was really life-changing. Elizabeth also is an exercise hound. Yeah, to find yourself in something that connects you like that does, or in exercise that really you learn to let go of things. And, you know, it's like a runner's high. I never understood that because I was never a runner, but I get that at SoulCycle, where you elevate to the next level and you kind of clear your head and the endorphins kick in, and it made me better and it gave me a clearer head and time to be emotional and to think. So exercise has been, and I know that exercise is also good in all sorts of, you know, mental health, but for grief recovery, I think exercise is key. In whatever you choose to do, golf, tennis, spinning, riding, you know, running, whatever it is, to reach mm-hmm. that endorphin level and realize that, you know, that you can feel good. And it's, of course, great for your body.
Right.
So that has been key in my recovery, key. And the SoulCycle community has been extraordinary. That helped too.
That's a blessing.
Yep.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been extraordinary.
So in wrapping up, how different are you today than 4 years ago?
I hope I'm core, fundamentally the same person. I've seen changes in me that I'm really happy about being less judgmental, about being more tolerant, a better friend, a better person. I think I'm more introspective. I'm more understanding. People may disagree. Mm-hmm. That might be just self-reflection, but I know that I've grown to do things that I was scared to do. You know, I travel so much now. I always wanted to. I initiate it. I'm a little bit more adventuresome, and then I'm a little bit more cautious. But I think I'm a fuller person, more self-realized, and certainly more self-fulfilled. Necessity being the mother of invention.
Right, exactly. And so who do you think you're going to be 4 years from now?
Wow, Lois, I wish I could answer that.
Well, do you have goals, objectives, or you learn not to have that, or you did learn to have that?
That's great. Well, as you're aware, and as I hope everybody who listens is aware, I am writing a book. So that's a goal and objective. But as a person, I've learned not to project into the future like that. And I've had this comment in a podcast before about relationships. you know, I don't really have any desire to remarry today. Will I feel that way in 4 years? I don't know. So the title of my book, Never Say Never, Never Say Always, that's how I live my life. So who will I be in 4 years? I hope better than I am now. I hope richer than I am now. I hope more to give than I do now. I've always said I want to be known for what I've given back to people. I want to love. I want to be loved. I hope to be better. Every day, I hope to be better. That's the goal here. But I have no long-term goals or projections anymore. I kind of have to let life happen. And that seems to be more successful. I had a vision of the future, and it shattered. Mm. So I'm not going back in on that. But I'm living with gusto, and I'm doing what I want, when I want, with whom I want. And I hope to be a better me, a better version of me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. And we thank you for being so honest and sharing everything. And hopefully, you know, people that listen to this will appreciate it and will be fruitful and rewarding for them too. I certainly have learned a lot. So thank you very much. Until next time, we're signing off.
Thanks, Lois.
Thank you.